Hello and welcome to Volume 105 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss the effect that rising CO2 levels have on plants. We'll talk about a new method for producing quality hardwoods. We'll talk about recreational uses of land, and we'll also talk to an expert in family conflict. I'm Hayes Brown of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Many forest owners are actually part of a family that owns forest land. This creates an overlay of family dynamics on a farming enterprise, but we've asked David Lansky, who is a clinical psychologist and has written a book on this topic, to tell us about what he's learned about managing family conflicts. Welcome, Dr. Lansky.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Is conflict really a frequent problem in family businesses?
Well, conflict is as frequent a problem in family business as it is in families. So it's often a part of a family life, and it's often a part of a family business life. But, you know, Hayes, conflict is not necessarily a bad thing. You know, often conflict, in fact, can be an opportunity for families to learn about how to deal better with each other. And sometimes families are very, very focused on trying to eliminate conflict, not address it at all. And often that's the heart of the problem, that conflict that exists that's not addressed sometimes undermines the plans of a family who are in business together.
What are some of the typical causes of conflict in a family business?
Well, first of all, you know, the families have relationships that have a long history to them. So often what happens in a family business is that the family relationships impose themselves into the business. So if there's been a history, for example, of sibling conflict in the family, that often will manifest itself in how the business is being operated. Another source of conflict in family business is the fact that families who work together have to wear a number of different hats. So, you know, not only am I your dad, but I'm your boss. And so that sets up these kind of conflicting expectations. It's, you know, father, boss, son or daughter employee is one set of kind of conflicting expectations. It gets even more challenging when siblings are working together. You know, it's there, you know, how can I be the boss of my brother? And sometimes it's not only the boss of my brother, but the boss of my older brother. So it's having these kind of wearing different hats and being able to understand which hat you're wearing at any given time is very, very important in family business.
Well, do you have any suggestions on dealing with these type conflicts in family businesses?
Well, we, you know, in our book, which is called Managing Conflict in Family Business, we review many different approaches to dealing with conflict. So, you know, one almost at the heart of dealing with conflict in family business is being able to manage expectations well. Because families wear these different hats when they work together, you know, father, boss, or, you know, older or younger brother, you know, boss to the older brother, whatever. What happens is there are these conflicting expectations that people have. So much of what we do, in our firm is the Family Business Consulting Group, and much of what we do is assist families to manage those expectations well. So how do we do that? Well, you know, first of all, having regular family meetings is very important. Being able to articulate what the values and vision are for family members who are working in the business and family members who are not working in the business. So having real clarity about values and vision. Creating policies rather than we're doing things this way because this is what Dad thinks we should do. Agreeing on policies so that all family members buy into the way things are done. And these are, so overall, you know, managing expectations and bringing some structure to how families are working together are really key elements in managing the conflict. And then finally, I would say that, you know, sometimes the conflict in a family is really kind of a, you know, a representation of history and historical factors. And sometimes what needs to happen is family members need to sit down with each other and actually talk about some of the emotional or relationship aspects that have got, that are getting in the way, that may be very uncomfortable for them to be dealing with. So okay. Again, having family meetings in a safe environment where people can feel trusting of each other and be able to open up in a safe way are key elements in resolving conflict.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Lansky. We appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Scott Jones is the CEO of the Forest Landowners Association, and we appreciate this organization's presence in Washington, D.C., and count on it to steer us in the right direction. Welcome, Scott.
Well, thank you, Hayes. We appreciate everything Alabama Forest Owners Association does as well.
Scott, we hear about the term expenditures a lot in tax discussions, but it sounds like a term of art. What can you explain what that is?
Yeah, just simply, tax expenditures are items that cost the government money by allowing exemptions or deductions or credits to a select group for a specific activity. One that we can all probably associate with is an expenditure that a lot of us take on our tax, our personal taxes, like the home mortgage interest deduction. And each Congress, there's a joint tax committee that gets together, and they issue a list, an actual list, of all the expenditures that are out there that cost the government money.
Okay. Now, if you look down that list, do you find any expenditures that relate to forestry?
Yeah, you know, and we have three main ones that relate to forestry, and we've had them for quite a long time. And just now, since we're talking about tax reform, since Congress is focusing on tax reform, these expenditures are coming up. But the three main ones that we rely on in forestry, the first one is deduction for timber growing costs, and that's just allows landowners to deduct operating costs in the year they're incurred, you know, rather than capitalizing those costs. The second one is timber revenue subject to capital gains. That's been in the Internal Revenue Code since 1943, and it treats the proceeds from timber harvest and the sale of standing trees as capital gains. And the third one, which is an important one that probably a lot of us have experienced as landowners, is the deduction and amortization of reforestation costs. And that's a really key part of the key expenditure for us, because the IRS currently recognizes the long-term nature of a forest land investment. And because of that, they allow us to deduct up to $10,000 of reforestation costs. They say per qualified timber property, that's a timber stand that you can deduct from. And then the rest of the cost can be amortized over a period of 7 years.
If, for some reason, these expenditures were repealed, what would be the impact to forest landowners?
Yeah, we've really been focusing on this a lot now, because since Congress is focusing on tax reform, everybody's on the table right now. And we're kind of, I'd say, tax expenditures for forestry look bright and shiny. They're right in everybody's view, because they are very specific to a very specific industry, forestry. And so a group called the National Alliance of Forest Owners actually commissioned a study to look at what the impact would be of repealing these tax provisions that we enjoy. And I'll throw a few numbers at you ask for a little grace because they're numbers. But it's reported that there'd be a 15% decline in domestic sales, totaling around $34 billion, and a loss of up to 140,000 jobs. A significant increase, of course, in the annual management costs for private landowners. You would probably see a restructuring of forest ownership because the real estate investment trust wouldn't be able to manage the way they're managing. And, of course, there'd be reduced federal tax revenue resulting from productivity declines and, of course, reduced sales and business restructuring in the forest industry. So the take-home message is, you know, if we can just continue maintaining the treatment that we have now, forestry would be good, but these items are on the table.
All right. Thanks, Scott. We appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Well, the discussions around climate change can sometimes lead to some interesting places. Climate change is thought to be universally bad for humans and animals, but what about plants? Craig Itso has a perspective that we wanted to learn more about. Hello, Dr. Itso.
Hi. Thanks for letting me be here.
What effect does rising atmospheric carbon dioxide have on trees?
Well, in large measure, it's a very great beneficial effect. And this is because, far from being a pollutant, atmospheric CO2 is what we refer to in the scientific community as an aerial fertilizer. And as has been demonstrated by literally thousands of laboratory and field studies conducted on trees and plants growing at various CO2 concentrations, the more CO2 in the air, the better plants grow. And there are three main benefits that atmospheric CO2 enrichment confers upon plants that allows for this great growth to occur. And the first is that of increased productivity. More CO2 means more growth. For most plants, most crops, non-woody plants or herbaceous plants, we expect to see about a 25 to 55% increase in their yields in the next 50 to 75 years as the CO2 concentration rises from about 400 parts per million in the atmosphere today to about 700 parts per million in the future. Now, for
what
trees,
are the other
on the
two, real quick. Yeah.
The other two, real mm-hmm. quick, are increased water use efficiency, how plants need to use about half as much water to produce the same amount of tissue and growth at higher CO2 concentrations as they do at lower concentrations. And the third one is atmospheric CO2 confers a great ability on plants to cope with environmental stresses. So stresses such as tropospheric ozone, low light, high soil salinity, things like that are actually ameliorated or lessened at higher CO2 concentrations.
Well, some of these benefits that you've described, you know, they all sound good: productivity, increased water efficiency, and the ability to cope with stress. But are these going to be negated by higher temperatures and less rainfall?
Great question. No, they will not. And the reason for that is because as elevated CO2 concentrations, as they rise, they actually affect the plants such that their optimum temperature for plant photosynthesis increases as well, so that they perform better under higher CO2 concentrations at these higher temperatures. And from the research that's been conducted to date on this topic, it's clear that this CO2-induced increase in this optimum temperature for plant photosynthesis is much more sufficient to accommodate for the predicted increases in temperature that the models are suggesting might occur in the future. Now, as for precipitation, here again, the enhanced water use efficiency of plants growing at higher CO2 concentrations will allow them, in most all instances, to totally compensate for any change in precipitation. So, no, I would say the benefits of CO2 enrichment will not be negated by rising temperatures or changing precipitation patterns, if they even do occur.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Edso. We appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
John O'Reilly is president of Minnesota Forestry Association, and we learned about some public service announcements about forestry that he was a part of, so wanted to talk with him. Hello, John.
Good morning. Good morning.
What gave you all the idea to do some public service announcements?
Well, engaging private woodland owners in Minnesota is a core effort, and we're looking for, you know, every way possible to do a better job at that. As gauged by our membership in our state association, I think Alabama is doing much better than we are. I think you've got over 6,000 members in your association. We have just 800 in ours. But so since engaging woodland owners is a core effort, somebody suggested PSAs, and we thought we had some money available. We thought we would try it out.
Okay. How did you produce them, and how did you get them out to radio stations?
We found a fellow in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, who's a freelancer, familiar with Minnesota forestry, and he did them for us all the way from writing the scripts to getting them produced and to distributing them to radio stations through a mass mailing type operation. But beyond that, we found that that mass mailing thing gets some interest, but actually very little. The best response we got was when members actually took a CD of the announcements and carried it into their local radio station.
Okay. Well, what was the response from the woodland owners?
Well, we would like to say that our membership skyrocketed. It has not. We've gotten a few new members, but besides membership, we're interested in having something in front of our members, just reminding them who we are and so on, and becoming better known among woodland owners in the general public. So a few new members, but mostly a little bit more awareness, I think, of us and our organization.
Okay. Well, thank you, John.
Sure.
Appreciate you telling us about that. Well, by now you know that lumber is best produced from straight, tall, well-limbed trees. Getting that from bottomland hardwoods is a little tricky, especially when these areas are planted with hardwoods. Dr. Ted Leininger has been working in this area, so we wanted to talk with him a little bit. Hello, Dr. Leininger.
Hello.
What are some of the concerns that landowners have with the traditional method of planting hardwood trees on marginal agricultural lands?
Well, listeners may be familiar with a number of the programs offered by USDA, primarily the Conservation Reserve Program and the Wetlands Reserve Program that have been offered for more than 20 years now. And traditional methods of establishing trees through these programs involve planting a mix of primarily oak species on 12-foot by 12-foot spacings at about 300 trees per acre. But the problem with that is you plant the trees on the former agricultural land, and you come back a number of years later. When you look out over there, what you'd see primarily is an old field succession occurring with various degrees of herbaceous and woody vegetation. You'd have to wade out in there and dig down amongst the weeds to find the oak trees. And so we realized early on that we wanted to look at a better way of establishing what eventually would be a mature bottomland hardwood forest on these sites, which is a greater benefit not only to the landowner but the society as a whole.
All right, why don't you tell us what you've been done to address these concerns you're describing?
Well, we looked around in the various species that are available in the alluvial valley here, and we took two species. We picked two species with very different silvical characteristics. First one was cottonwood, which is considered a pioneer species, which means that it generates on new soil, such as at the edges of streams and rivers. It has a very rapid growth form. It can grow on some sites up to 12 to 15 feet per year, and has a very narrow crown. And we matched that with oaks. In our particular case, in our research, we used nuttall oak, which is considered a later successional species, slower growing, and of a higher timber value. And we planted these trees on the landscape in a tic-tac-toe fashion, every other row, 12-foot by 12-foot on the cottonwood, interspersed with 12-foot by 12-foot spacing of the oaks. And what now, when the landowner goes out following a couple of years after the planting, instead of seeing this mass of weedy and shrubby vegetation, he or she will see what we consider, we'll call an instant forest. You'll have cottonwoods that are 20 to 30 feet in height, interspersed with oaks that are a few feet in height. And then, say, at year 20, you may have a cottonwood forest at 50 to 60 feet tall and with oaks in the neighborhood of 20 feet or more. Mm-hmm. And the advantage to the timber production are several. One, you'll over the life of this stand, you'll be able to get several cottonwood pulpwood rotation harvests. And at the end of, say, 60 to 80 years, you'll have the possibility of harvesting oaks that have very high-quality saw timber logs because the cottonwood crowns have shaded out the branches on the lower part of the oak stems and allowed the oaks to develop very high-quality straight boles with very few knots due to the branches.
Is this something that's actually happening now, or is this a theoretical project?
It actually is happening. We're very proud of the fact that a private company has adopted and adapted our research and has, working in Arkansas, Louisiana, and Mississippi primarily, has already planted more than 5,000 acres or more than 3 million trees in this cottonwood oak interplanting method, and is using it not only to as on a carbon market, but also for producing timber as well.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Leininger.
Thank you.
Well, you've heard the saying, you can't see the forest for the trees, but it's also sometimes true that you can't see the minerals for the trees. Minerals on forest land can actually be more valuable than the trees and the land itself. So we wanted to talk to Lewis Dean with the Geological Survey of Alabama and see what he has to say. Welcome, Lewis.
Yes, thank you.
What mineral resources are in Alabama?
Well, there are a variety of mineral resources that are actually mined in the state currently, and they occur all across the state in select areas, and some of the more common ones that the listeners may be familiar with are crushed stone for construction, and that would include limestone, dolomite, quartzite, and granite. That's probably one of the most extensive mining operations for crushed stone. The other minerals mined in the state are clay and shale, and those are used in brick manufacturing plants, especially. Other commodities well known are marble, which is from Sylacauga, the historic marble area, is an industrial mining operation. Mica, sand and gravel are some of the other common mineral resources mined in the state.
You didn't even mention coal, though.
No, coal is an energy resource, and that's somewhat separated from the industrial minerals. But
sure.
Coal is the most developed mining industry in the state for power generation. And
sure.
We have a separate office that deals entirely with coal.
Okay. What if a person is new to this topic,
what information
is available on mineral resources?
There's a variety of information that's been gathered by our office, which includes geologic mapping to show what rock formations have been mapped in the state and in particular areas. And from that, you can identify what mineral resources are associated with those. We also have a variety of publications and reports describing specific commodities, specific areas, and each county has a mineral resource study that's available to show in more detail what mineral resources would be found in a specific area of the state.
All right, take it down to an individual property owner. How does a novice determine what minerals are on his land, his or her land?
Well, the easiest way is to contact our office with the property location. That would be the most important thing we would need, is the specific location of the property, either by county or highway or specific land section, township, and range. And from that, we can look up what data is available on that specific property to indicate what the geologic formations are mapped on the surface and what associated mineral resources are found on that area. And in some cases, the property owner may find abandoned ore pits or mines. That information can be used to look up what historic mining activity has taken place on a property.
All right. Well, thank you, Lewis.
Thank you.
Well, when to rent and when to buy, that's a decision homeowners face, but it's also a decision forest owners face when selecting equipment to do chores on their property. Wes Smith is with United Rentals. Hello, Wes.
How you doing?
Tell us about the typical use of the equipment your company provides that our members could benefit from.
All right. With the wide range of equipment that we carry, I was trying to think of things that your landowners would use the most, and it seems like if any of your landowners are having to clear a road, they're going to need bulldozers, they're going to need backhoes. There's going to be landowners that own pine trees that need to pick the cones or do seeding or any kinds of trimming. They would need man lifts of different kinds to get up 40, 50, 60, even 80 feet that we would be able to offer to your association members. There's also skid steers that they would use for just simple clearing to clear out an area, develop some parts of their land. Stump removal would be a very big deal with backhoes or mini excavators. You can also use mini excavators if you're having to update some water lines, dig water lines, and you're close to a building or close to a house and you don't have a lot of area to get around. Auger and auger attachments for your skid steers are very handy whenever you're having to build fences, fence posts, and you've got a long way to go and you have to dig multiple holes. And then lastly, I would say reach forklift and material handling. Many landowners lease their land to hunting clubs, and they could be using the reach forklift to do updates and additions to their hunting lands.
Okay. I'm assuming you're pro lease, leasing or renting equipment. Why don't you tell us why you think that renting is a better alternative in some situations to buying something?
Sure. There's always a need that you're going to have to own a certain things that are core to your business, but with the amount of land that most of your members own, there's always going to be something that comes up that you just can't justify making that purchase. So I wanted to highlight a few things that would help your members, but any time that you rent anything, it's 100% tax deductible. So that's one advantage. Second thing is you don't always have to own a wider range of equipment and tie up all your capital assets in owning all that equipment. You may have to own one or two pieces, but if you're only using a backhoe twice a year, do you really need to own that piece of equipment when you can rent it and capture that capital back and then write it off on your taxes? There's also no maintenance on a rental equipment. If you rent a piece of equipment from United Rentals for a month, the piece of equipment goes down, you pick up the phone and call us. We come out there, either we'll bring you a replacement or fix the one that you already have. There's no depreciation. So if you own something, you have to depreciate it. If it's a rental, there's no depreciation. We absorb that cost. It's also a good way to demo a piece of equipment where if you feel like you're going to have a dozer and you want to decide between a John Deere 550 or a John Deere 450, you could rent one and see if that smaller size would work before you went out and actually made the investment to buy. And with over 20 locations across the state, it's very easy for any of your members to be driving distance to come actually to our facility, see what we have, jump on the equipment, see how it works, and then get it lined up to come out to your facility or your land to do improvements.
All right. Well, thank you, Wes. We appreciate that.
One last thing I want to say that we are going to be offering a 10% discount on all rentals for any member of your association.
Oh, well, thank you. I didn't expect that. We sure do appreciate that offer. That's very nice of you.
Thank you.
Brent Galloway is with a business called Coal Creek Company. They recently got into providing places for off-road vehicles. We hoped we might learn from their experience. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
Coal Creek has been around since 1872, and y'all have been a natural resource company. When did you get into the recreation business?
That's right. We've been in business since 1872 and have coal, oil, gas, a sustainable timber harvesting program. And we've primarily been a natural resource business for 140 years. And a lot of local people in the area here started riding dirt bikes and jeeps and things many years ago on our trails. Most of the trails were results of past mining and past logging activities here, and it got to be a popular place to ride. And basically, Coal Creek didn't do anything about it. They didn't know how to handle the use. They could say put up no trespassing signs, and it really didn't do any good on a piece of property this large. And so, in 2000, they decided to embrace riders and start charging for that service. And opening our property up to legal riding, and we currently have trails for all types of vehicles, and we started selling daily land use permits, and you could buy 2-day or 3-day permits or an annual land use permit, and we hired bought some equipment and hired a trail crew, and we now have two full-time employees that are fully dedicated to maintaining our trails.
Tell us how this has worked out for your company and where you see it going in the future.
It has actually been a very, very valuable part of our business. As economies change and demand for natural resources goes up and down, demand for recreation seems to stay fairly consistent. It is certainly economic based as well, but it has become a top end producer of money within our company and a very valuable asset. We can't change the market price of timber. We can't change the market price of coal. But we can do marketing and increase revenues from our customers on the recreation side.
Okay.
We have built a campground that has cabins, RV sites, tent camping, et cetera, that caters exclusively to our OHV riders, and are doing some other projects on the property here that will help increase increase business and cater to our customers.
All right. Well, thank you, Brent. Appreciate that. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to David Lansky, Scott Jones, Greg Edso, and John O'Reilly. We also appreciate the contributions of Ted Leiniger, Lewis Dean, Wes Smith, and Brent Galloway. In a recent Associated Press investigation, it was noted that not a single wind farm has been prosecuted for killing eagles and other protected species. More than 573,000 birds are killed by wind farms each year, including hawks, falcons, and eagles. While oil companies have been prosecuted for harming birds, no alternative wind energy company has. Former Interior Secretary Ken Salazar denies such a preference, but it does raise the issue of whether some preferred energy providers are getting a pass. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.